Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words, which sometimes sounds like a tongue twister, like toy boat. Do you agree, Emily?
Yeah, I can't say that five times fast.
It looks like Waldman's sword. Like a sword in the stone when I look at it on paper.
I never saw that, but now I will never be able to unsee it.
Fist pound. Or fist bump, not pound.
Yeah, we've learned.
Oh, God, I'm sorry. All right, so we've got Mike Glitta, who is on the opposite coast, and I have envy on that coast. Oh, I know, we're starting this off really well. So Mike Glitta is a fellow artist manager, and I'm not sure if he remembers this, but I think that we talked at Warped Tour in 2006. I think we did because we both played it, but Census Fail was on a much bigger stage than the City Drive. We were on Smart Punk, and I think Census Fail even played main stage and did some acoustic, which was pretty cool. But we reacquainted on that social media site, I believe, called Facebook, and now Emily is here to say five words about Mike.
Mike Glitta, I stalked you on the internet last night, and you seem like a really cool dude.
Wow. I mean, that was a little more than five words,
yeah,
but I'll take
it. He deserves it.
He deserves at least seven words, or eight Graves words. Oh, another fist bump. So anyway, the next few weeks are going to be stockpiled with fun episodes. I was just in New York and Florida, so this is the first time I'm in Adobe Studios in quite a while. And so we've got, obviously, this episode is Mike Glitta. The following week, let's see if you know this, who is next?
Louis?
Yeah, Louis Bandak, who signed Yellow Card. That's all I have to say. He signed Yellow Card. I love Yellow Card. He also signed May, and Capitol put out one of the most underrated May albums of all time, Singularity, that I think four people bought, and I bought one of them. I really like it. A lot of people don't, so sorry. The following week after that, we've got Adam Mott, who it's really cool to me because I guess going back to Jersey and Glitta, he managed Thursday. And I'm a huge Thursday fan now and forever. And they actually played Warped Tour 2006. So this is just like a really incestuous episode. So sorry in advance, Glitta, for that. We've got the following week, we've got Eric German, who is the attorney for Black Veil Brides. Did you watch the APMAs?
I watched the red carpet.
Did people look really nice?
They did. They looked great. Everyone looked great.
Name one person who looked good and say why.
The owners or the founders of Emo Night.
Oh.
Brought an entire case of Pabst onto the red carpet. It was A+.
That looked good because they soaked themselves in Pabst and some PBR.
I mean, it was a look. It was, you know, they took a chance and I think it really paid off.
They have this whole elegantly disheveled look that looks like it took a really long time to look that out of it, but
yeah,
it's perfect.
I appreciate it too.
I appreciate you. And then the following week, we have another Warped Tour 2006 person, Shane Told from the band Silver Scene. This was not intentional, Mike, but you know what? We're gonna get right to it in a few. Every single Tuesday night, 5 p.m. Pacific time. I learned recently not to say PST, I say PT, because sometimes with time zone changes, it's different timing. Did you know that?
No. Oh, yeah, because Arizona or something.
Arizona doesn't change. There's no daylight savings there. Arizona, yeah. And metaphorically, it doesn't change either. Stay away.
I never think about Arizona that hard.
So. I don't think people there do either. Anyway, I love you, Arizona and Kansas. Special shout out to Kansas for the person recording us right now, Andrew. He is not only wearing one Kansas item, he's wearing two. And, oh, he speaks. And Shane Told is from Canada, and Mike Litt is from Jersey, and this episode is going to be awesome. And Eastern time, ET, 8 o'clock. Everyone who watches Waldman's Words is silly because it's not a show to watch. Everyone who listens to Waldman's Words is awesome. And in a few minutes, we're going to have Mike on the air. Stay tuned. Hello, we are back with Mike Glitta. Mike, say hello and introduce yourself to Emily, Andrew, and the millions and billions of people listening right now.
What's going on, guys? My name's Mike. I am an artist manager, entrepreneur, former rocker, I guess.
You still
like
rock,
you, Scott.
You still
and
rock.
Just here for the fun.
Well, we appreciate that. And when I was asking how to pronounce your name to you, I want you to repeat almost verbatim how you did that because I couldn't have come up with a better analogy or sentence. So what's the best way to pronounce Glitta?
I probably say it the same way to most people when they meet me. Basically, if you are from New York, maybe Jersey, and you're thinking of The Sopranos, and you were talking about that sparkly stuff, glitter, how would you say it? You'd be like, "Yo, put some glitter on your face." So,
That's
that's
awesome.
it.
You put some schmutz on your face. So before
Exactly.
we get to the really important stuff, I want to ask you the most important question ever. Do you like the movie Glitta with Mariah Carey?
The movie Glitter with Mariah Carey. I have actually never seen it. I heard it got rave reviews. It was one
Oh.
of.
It won every award ever for best. It basically is honestly, they called it the modern Citizen Kane. Did you see it, Emily?
Really?
No. You didn't see Glitta?
I've never heard of it.
But you're talking to Glitta, and you haven't seen Glitta?
No, I'm sorry.
What the heck is wrong with
Well,
you? Why are you co-hosting? You haven't seen Glitta? I need. Because I haven't seen it, but I saw From Justin to Kelly, and that movie
I've
sucked.
never seen that either.
Okay,
I didn't
God.
know that was
Glitta,
criteria.
what's your favorite movie? And then we're gonna get to the real important shit again. What's your favorite movie featuring a current or former pop star?
Holy moly.
Yeah. Hard-hitting questions with Scott Waldman.
I can't really say I have a favorite movie. I definitely have a lot of them.
All right.
Definitely a big fan of the 80s movies, just like I am of the music,
Okay.
especially 80s love ballads, which I do have. Well, I did have at one point the 10 CD collection of the 80s greatest love ballads. But no, I love a lot of those movies from the 80s, like all those,
Like
teen
Goonies.
movies and Goonies and
Yeah.
things like that. Big fan of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Lord of the Rings,
You like the
Meet
indie
Sweet
films
Dork.
like Star Wars and Indiana Jones. Indiana
Yeah,
Jones. Like those movies,
exactly.
honestly, I hope they catch on someday because they have a lot of talent in those movies. My favorite movie from the 80s is Stand By Me, and it doesn't get spoken about enough. So I'm going to say it again. Stand By Me.
Also a good one. Also a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would consider myself a movie buff. I've probably seen at least 10 to 15,000 movies in my life.
Wow.
The Graduate's definitely one of my favorite of all time.
It's a good one.
Good Will Hunting,
I saw that on my
Shawshank
first date
Redemption.
with this girl, and it was my last date. Good Will
Yeah.
Hunting. I actually got dropped off at the movie theater in the car by some parental figure. We saw the movie. It was great, but it ended a lot better for Will than Scott. That's all I'm gonna say.
I'm
Anyway,
sorry to hear
so, well, thank
that.
you. So, I dug a little deep, pun intended. Talk to me about skiing because I had no idea that you had that strength. I could ski a double diamond without falling, but I look really stupid. So I imagine you're doing all these moguls and crazy things. I want to hear about that.
Well, actually, I can ski moguls. It was never something that I was big on. I was more into the racing side of skiing.
I'm nodding my head.
Yeah. So it's kind of weird for being a kid from New Jersey to get into that. Long story short, had a friend that lived up the road at the time when I was a kid, took my family skiing one time. Always had supportive parents, so they kind of basically just asked if it was something that my brother and I liked, and we started going more often,
Where'd
and
you
that
go,
turned into
though?
every weekend.
Where'd you go?
We went to Camelback in
Okay.
Pennsylvania.
Got you.
And so, yeah, it turned into every weekend. And then I kind of did recreational racing. They had like this little team there where it was just kind of like a weekend thing where, you were with a bunch of other kids, almost like, I don't even want to call it a sports camp, but not really like that. It went from the weekend program to they had like sort of like a traveling, race team there.
How old
And
were
I
you
do
at that
race.
point?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. How old were you at that point when you, I guess, got much more into it and much more competitive about it?
It definitely happened pretty quickly. So the first time I went skiing, I believe I was 6 or 7, and by the time I was about 9, I was actually like kind of traveling more and racing. We did races in like New Jersey and Pennsylvania, occasionally New Hampshire or Vermont. And I
I
don't know.
went to
I guess I
Mount
kind of
Snow,
did pretty
dude.
well pretty quickly. When I was a kid, I was like placing top 3, top 5 in all my races when I started out, and then. Around 7th grade, I had some ski academies contact me, and in 8th grade, I went out to Colorado and Crested Butte, and went to a ski academy for that. And then
Is
in
it
high
kind of
school,
like
I was up in
Police
Stratton, Vermont.
Academy for skiing? Is it like the 80s romp Police Academy? Aha.
It's kind of like what was it, ski patrol or ski school, right?
Or Camp Nowhere for skiing.
Camp Nowhere. Yeah, exactly. I think the funny part about it is, especially when I was going the first time I was going in 8th grade, I mean, my school, I was at a public school, they had no clue what I was doing, and they didn't believe me that I was actually going to be doing any work. Most people seem to think you're just going and skiing all day, but it's pretty regimented.
Like surfing,
There's a lot
man.
of there's a lot of
Surfers,
training.
surfers are
Sorry.
ripped. No, you don't need to. This is what you're actually really respectful on the phone, and you pause, and you're good at this. And I'm trying my hardest not to be a dick and interrupt you. But basically, sometimes I fail at that. My bad. But basically, a lot of people get the bad rap associated with like ski bum because that is literally the way they describe it, or surfer bro. But those guys who surf, they wake up when it's like 3, 4 a.m. Every single one of them, it's a battle of who's in better shape. And obviously for skiing, you have to be in great shape. My wife's family actually owns a ski resort called Catamount. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
I do know Catamount.
There you go. Well, let me know next time you want to go. I know a guy.
I'll keep that in mind.
That guy is me. So anyway, so did you ski with a base in your hand? Like, how did that transition happen?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, the funny part is, I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I think I always knew I wanted to be involved with music in some capacity, and obviously sports, which I love. Those are my two biggest passions, I guess. And
I heard you like Rutgers basketball. I heard that rumor. I could be wrong.
yeah, it's a tough one. Tough sore
I went to
subject.
Michigan, dude. Michigan had the Fab Five. That's all I could say. I don't think they've done well literally since I was in high school, but there was a time when they were the top of it. And I think now it's Duke. And I know nothing about sports, so this is where my Emily, what's your favorite sports and team in the sports and
I think soccer. Any soccer team, pick one, I don't care.
Anyone with Beckham, man. Any team with Beckham.
Beckham's been retired for a long time.
Oh my God, I just got freaking outwitted. I'm sorry. Go back to you, Mike, because right now Emily just put me in a place and literally she moved her hand and dropped a mic and gave me the finger. So there you go. This show is brought to you by Wit. So anyway, so bass guitar. I play bass, you play bass. And I also heard a rumor that you play drums and you sing. You're like basically like Brian Wilson, motherfucker. That's you. And you were in Tokyo Rose. Was that pre-Senses Fail, I believe? Please
That
tell me I'm
was.
right. Okay. You know I performed with Tokyo Rose at Lido Beach once.
I believe you had mentioned this, but I wasn't in the band at the time.
You were definitely not in the band at the time. In fact, I don't even think you were in Senses Fail when I did that. I know we're kind of going tangential, but that was in 2007. It was the Knitting Factory in Manhattan, which was my favorite venue to ever play. It was Bed Light for Blue Eyes was our direct support. Sound the Alarm. Tokyo Rose was first of four that night. So there you go.
Yeah, I was in Senses Fail at that time, but Tokyo Rose had gone through so many member changes by the time I left.
Yes, they
I'm
did.
still good friends with Ryan, the singer.
Isn't he a
We
pastor
kind
now?
of. Sorry, what?
Isn't he like a pastor now? I feel like he does, I don't know, youth ministries or so. I don't know. I could be wrong, but that's what it feels like.
Yeah, he does something with the church like that, where it's sort of, he's not a pastor exactly, I believe, but it's more, being involved with his church and the community and events and whatnot.
You know, Adam from Homegrown is a pastor, and I feel that Dustin from Thrice was one. It's like all these like Warped Tour bands see the light, and I am in this pit of darkness right now with Mike Glitta. So I guess tell me about Senses Fail, because you guys were one of those bands that had a shit ton of buzz. I can tell you that from a guy who was in college at the time when everything happened. Like, how did that all start your career as a quote unquote legitimate musician, because in my opinion, you are. In fact, I would argue you're more legitimate than I am. So props to you, motherfucker.
Well, appreciate it. I mean, I don't know. I think my career, honestly, as a musician, really started It started before Tokyo Rose. While Senses Fail was one of those things that definitely launched my career into making that a full-time thing, it really just started by grinding and the whole DIY type mentality. That's I think where anyone who hopefully has the opportunity to be able to make it somewhat of a living or, get on the road, it starts with just hustle and figuring out how to make things work. And for me, it was, how do I find band members? How do I find a band? And then once I do that, how do I get my band to show? And, I literally went from playing in basements and VFW halls to figuring out that I had to sell 100 tickets to open for some bigger band and, the politics behind that. And from there, it was just kind of, one step after another. One of my favorite quotes, anyone who knows me well knows this probably, but Seneca the Younger, luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity. Honestly, Senses Fail would have never happened for me if I wasn't out there and hustling and grinding and doing my own thing and meeting the right people. So, at that point where, I decided to leave Tokyo Rose and I was working on my own music, it just so happened that Garrett from Senses Fail, the guitar player, he was doing the website for Tokyo Rose. So he already knew me. And little do many people know, probably no one really knows this outside of a few.
Exclusive on the air, exclusive on the air.
I actually tried out for Senses Fail on drums before I was ever the bass player. And
Dude,
basically, it
Dan's a
was
good
back when it
drummer,
was just
man.
Buddy and Garrett.
Dan's a really good
And they had
drummer.
a drummer at the time.
Ah.
And they asked me to play drums. I knew there was something there, but I just told them, I was like, I don't think, you don't have a band yet, which they didn't. It was just the two of them. And so I went off and started writing my own stuff, and they continued doing what they were doing. And Senses Fail's first show was actually opening for Tokyo Rose, and that was my last show with Tokyo Rose.
So you pass yourself a torch.
Yeah, I did. And at that time, they got a drummer who was 14 years old, and I thought he killed it. And they had a band together. And basically, when I decided to go off and record my own material, I asked Garrett if he wanted to help do some of the guitar parts because I was going to do everything myself, and it would have been nice to have somebody else, alleviate some of that. And he's like, "This sounds similar to what I'm working on. We don't have a bass player anymore. Do you want to play bass in our band?" "Sure, why not?"
I have a
And
question. Wait, just a quick detour. Were you at Rutgers at the time when you were doing this, or was this after you graduated, or was this even before you started Rutgers?
this was I was at Rutgers at the time.
Okay.
I actually that was the summer after sophomore year.
Okay. Paint a picture actually with the year, like say the specific year, just so I can like see a color. Was it
This was
2000,
2002.
2001, 2002? Okay. So this was when, at the time, I saw a co-headlining tour with Juliana Theory and Something Corporate. So this is just as Drive Thru was really rising with Finch, with Newfound Glory, with Starting Line. I believe Say It Like You Mean It came out in 2002. I think Sticks and Stones did as well. So this is when Drive Thru was really apexing, correct?
Yes, you are
Dope.
right.
Well, that's because I consulted my history book before this talk. No, I don't know why I just did a lisp, and the person who's recording me doesn't even know me. His name is Andrew, and he just shook his head in pure disgust. So I appreciate that. Thank you. I just did a fist pound or fist bump. He laughed. Ha ha. Babe Ruth struck out a lot, Mike. So how did you graduate from Rutgers before you signed, or did you delay school when you guys signed? Because I know that Senses Fail, in addition to being a big buzz band, was also a big buzz band for a lot of crazy label stuff. So, do you want to talk about that, or do you want to just move forward?
Well, just as far as the school thing goes, yeah, I mean, I went for 2 years. It's funny because I always kind of knew that I was like, I'm going to finish school, but I don't want to do it now, and it's not going to happen now. And I just had this idea in my head that I was going to get on the road somehow. And over that time, like, there were a few opportunities where, I was trying to make it happen, obviously. And I spent a lot of time trying to meet people and either join the right band or r write the right songs for myself. And I tried out for Armor for Sleep at one point too.
Wasn't Ben in Tokyo Rose 2? Like, I mean, it's like, or am I completely misinformed? That whole Jersey scene between, Thursday and My Chemical Romance, between Midtown and Thursday, was Ben a part of Tokyo Rose at some point?
He was not. He was in a band called Random Task.
That's with Evan Winokur.
Yep, he was in the band with
There you
Evan
go.
Whitaker.
There you go. Of Steel Train and
Yeah, I
now
mean, it's
Manager.
crazy going back to that stuff. It was Random Task. Evan Whitaker and Ben were in the band together, and then you had Prevent Falls, which had PJ
From
and
Armor, right?
Nash from Armor for Sleep, and they were on Equal Vision at the time. And then there was also this band called Outline, which had Jack Antonoff from Fun and
Bleachers,
Bleachers.
Steel Train. Fun fact, Lido Beach opened for Steel Train the day Obama got elected, and it was nuts. And also, I'm going to get political. I know that you probably don't like that, but Prop 8 passed that day too, banning gay marriage. So it was crazy fucking day. But I am forever a Steel Train fan. And just for you, just so you know, Senses Fail has a special place in my heart, especially Still Searching. And I know you're a part of that. So I just wanted to say thank you for being a part of a record that I still listen to and still love. So there you go.
Well, thank you. I mean, that was definitely a record that I know we all poured a lot into as a band. The interesting part about that, though, especially, was the fact that a lot of people thought our musicianship had jumped up such a big notch from the record before, which was true. But a big reason why it seemed like it happened in such a short period of time was because the record before had been delayed so long to come out. So we had, most bands, whatever, you finish, finish, maybe right on tour a bit, but you finish a tour, your final tour of whatever record you're on, and you probably spend 4 to 6 months working on the next record, and it comes out.
If you have money.
With Senses Fail, we had I guess extra time, which was good in a way because there were definitely times where we were going a bit off on a tangent, figuring out where we wanted our sound to go. But eventually we honed it back in. Like in the beginning, we had ideas that were like sounded like Boston, like not
Really?
even joking.
That's awesome.
So eventually, I remember thinking to myself too, when we needed a guitar player, it was like, who do I know that can do what I think we should be doing? Which is, I felt like not very many bands from that scene were, I guess, stepping it up a notch, as far as the musicality goes, trying to take some songs to the next level where maybe there are solos. Maybe we can bring back some of that 90s rock vibe
I would say
to what
Coheed at
we're
that
doing,
time was doing it. Coheed was really amping their musicianship game too. And I felt that did Still Searching come out in 06?
It did, yeah.
Okay, I mean, in particular that year, like a lot of bands were definitely like Saves the Day put out their angriest, fastest, hardest record at that time, and Every Time I Die and Atreyu were definitely really, really stepping up musicianship wise. But I felt that Still Searching just had the aggression, the shredding courtesy of Heath as well from Midtown, and the melody. And honestly, I would say it's probably one of my favorite records of the last decade. I'm gonna say that one more time. Like, I know that everyone loves Let It Unfold You, and I do like Let It Unfold You, but Still Searching, I feel is the zenith. So there you go.
Well, I mean, in my mind, like, sure, I completely understand why, just, as a music fan, like, I understood why when we first put out our EP and people said that nothing we would do would compare to that. I mean, you get attached to one thing, and that's the kind of sound or vibe that you feel you like from an artist, and it's hard to get away from that. But without a doubt, to me, Still Searching was definitely the best record. I mean, at least when I was in the band, the best record that we made, by far, music wise, writing, lyrics, it just all kind of came together. And like I said, when we were going to write the next record, Garrett had been playing along to Dire Straits and Boston and tons of stuff, and he his musicianship as a guitar player had jumped up significantly. All of us really were just improving a lot.
Buddy is
And
a vocalist too. Everyone. We're gonna cut this off in a second, and we'll close the census fail chapter on this side of the interview, and then we'll go into Love Automatic, William Morris, and your ventures into being a part of the dark side. But what you said actually was something that resonated, and for me, Saves the Day is a band that I feel has made different albums pretty much every time. I mean, one could argue that Can't Slow Down is very similar to Through Being Cool, and I would agree with that, but every album has been different. But for me, listening to You Vandal in 1999, like Through Being Cool is my Saves the Day record. So it's just a lot of people tend to identify with the earlier stuff, whereas there's some kids right now that Blink-182's California is their favorite album. And how are they wrong? That's what they're growing up in. So, care to comment on nostalgia versus progression quickly before we siphon to the next part?
yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. It's tough because as you get older, in my youth here, I'm still a baby, right? But as you get older, you start to realize that, I think the worst thing that people can do, especially in music, but it goes with tech, it goes with business, right? Like, if you want to know what's happening, it's always good to be tapped into the younger generation, the younger people. If it's tech, it's like, what's the new app? What's the new thing that people are talking about? If it's music, it's trying to sit there and figure out why people like something. And for me, I think I've always kind of been able to gauge that pretty well. Like, there are plenty of younger, newer artists that, a lot of people, our age, not to date us, but a
No,
lot of
you're
people would
dating
be
us.
like,
I
I don't get
won't.
this. I don't understand it. Take something like mumble rap. To me, I do get it. I do get why people like it. It might not be something I completely love, but there's something about that music that has almost a nursery rhyme kind of melody to it that it's very easy to remember and to, if people like the beat, they're gonna dance to it, And so there's this thing between between nostalgia and even what's popular now. I mean, people are going to always hold on to the past. It doesn't matter what it is, right? There's a song that you loved when you were a kid. I mean, any one of us could sit here and like, I could tell you what year I remember hearing any song and like what was going on in my life at that time. So sometimes it's hard for people to distance themselves from nostalgia, versus something new. But I think I've always been good at like realizing like, you could take an artist that had a record 10 years ago and I can hear it now and be like, I can see why someone would like this and someone would like something from the past, but it's definitely, in anything in your life, it's definitely hard to separate, feelings that you had when you were a kid, because I'm sure you've had those conversations with plenty of people. We all do at some point where it's like, is this good? Like, would I like this if I were
Objectively,
16?
objectively. Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say two quick things and then we're gonna cut it off. I can tell you, factually speaking, Taking Back Sunday is a much better band now than they were with Tell All Your Friends, but I just love Tell All Your Friends, imperfections and all. So there you go with that. And thing number two, I posted this on my Instagram and I think Emily Burke click like on it, and possibly you. I just get so mad at the people who bitch about the fidget spinner, because people our age had a fucking pet rock, and that is so much dumber than a fidget spinner. So it's like people, like, if this makes these kids happy and they're not throwing the fidget spinner with blades in anyone's faces, who the fuck are we to judge it? So I'm gonna take a quick break. I know you probably need one for my mad intense interview. So we're gonna take a quick commercial break, wherein Emily will probably just recite Bounty, the Quilted Quicker Picker Upper, the entire time. Can you do that?
I actually cannot.
Thank you. All
So
right.
let's choose another song.
All right. I'm actually not going to do that. Stick around. Welcome back to Waldman's Words with Emily Burke. Andrew, I'm not even going to butcher your last name. And Mr. Mike Glidda, the man of the literal hour. If you can have one word to describe the previous 24-minute segment, what would it be?
Oh man.
That's two words.
Significant.
Oh, wow. You know what word I would use?
What's that?
Unreal.
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 Unreal. Extreme. All right. Anyway, so let's Love Automatic, man. I want to hear about that. I want to hear about that experience, and then we're going to go to where you sold out and became a businessman.
Please. well, Love Automatic. When I had left Census Fail, I actually was doing kind of a side project writing team with my buddy Nick. And basically, we weren't exactly sure what we wanted to be, but I tried to take a stab at, you know, singing and writing some songs and seeing if we could sell them to people and seeing what we could do on our own. And it was funny because that kind of like happened all pretty quickly, where it got to the point where we put out like just a song up on, at the time, dating ourselves, MySpace. We put up a song and somehow it wound up on like the front page of a bunch of, you know, whatever, like MySpace Australia and maybe MySpace US. I don't know. And the song ended up getting like 35 million streams on it.
Whoa. That's like Chainsmokers status, dude. Like 35 million streams? What
yeah,
the
I don't know.
Fuck?
I don't know.
That's
what
bigger
happened.
Than Census Fail's entire catalog combined.
Yeah, so it was really weird.
Gangnam Style?
All of a sudden we had,
was
like,
it Gangnam
managers
Style?
Contacting us.
Ah, managers contact. Was it Irving Azoff knocking on your door? Like, dude, that's insane. That's a high number.
Yeah, it was close. It was close, but I don't know. I just never saw myself as a frontman. It's just not. I don't want to say not in the cards for me. It's just not something that I really want to do.
You're the frontman on this call, though. Just so you know, the flyer is you. It's not me. So you are officially like the Hulk Hogan of today. So enjoy it.
Oh wow. Well, thank you.
What you gonna do, brother?
I like hearing you laugh. It makes me so basically, so Nick and I were doing that, and then Nick had this other band, and basically we decided to start, we took that, put members together, and formed Love Automatic, which had a few different iterations of it. But my whole goal with that was, you know, what if we could be like the Electro House version of Nine Inch Nails? And I say that meaning if anyone has seen Nine Inch Nails live.
I have. I saw Marilyn Manson singing Starfuckers with them and Perfect Circle opening, and it was amazing. And Nine Inch Nails is the ultimate live rock show with lights, camera, action. Can't believe I just
exactly.
Did that.
So
tell me about their show. Did you see them on like the Fragile or on Downward Spiral tour, or was it a little bit post that?
I saw them in 2006 or no, it was 2008. Okay. It was on the, what the heck was that album called?
The one with the hand 10, that feeds 000. On it or not Year Zero. What was
the one before it?
Oh fuck. Well, I know that Dave Grohl drummed on that. Oh, it was called Still Searching by Census Fail.
Yeah, that's what it was called. Okay. Actually, it wasn't Dave Grohl. It was Josh Freese.
No, Dave Grohl drummed on The Hand That Feeds. But Josh Freese, not only did he drum on Perfect Circle and GNR, but eventually he was just like Devo too, and The Vandals. My God, I sound like an encyclopedia. I worship that man. But he did drum for Nine Inch Nails. But Dave Grohl actually, around the same time that he did Queens of the Stone Age, he was contemplating quitting Foo Fighters, and he was just doing like all these big drum records and listen to No One Knows and listen to the production and realize the drums are louder than everything. Just
cool.
But anyway, Nine Inch Nails. So what about Nine Inch Nails? Like, how did you attempt to emulate that with Love Automatic?
So for me, I've always appreciated what Trent did and his vision, and I've kind of felt the same way about myself where I've always been an artist. I was a drawer, obviously music, anything in the art world, I just kind of gravitate toward. And I just felt like, what if you had electro house music where you could go to.
Hello? I believe we lost him.
But you actually had a singer and a drummer and a guitar player and a DJ playing.
Wait, Mike. Sorry, we lost you for a second. Can you repeat that one more time? The signal went out.
Oh, yeah. When I think of Nine Inch Nails, you know, as being an influence on what I've done in the past, Trent's always been kind of a visionary. And I kind of think the same way, I think, as far as, you know, what's the big picture of what you want to do. And, I figured, is there a way to make electronic music, to make electro house dance music, where you have a singer, a drummer, a guitar player, and a DJ on stage. And we'd have a light show, much like Nine Inch Nails does, that would kind of put you in the moment. So it was this kind of all-encompassing thing where you could be at the show and you could just be dancing and have a good time, or you could actually be watching a show happen. And part of the problem that I came across doing that at the time was that, even our label said that, they thought we're maybe kind of ahead of the curve, because there weren't many DJs doing stuff like that. It was either, we talked to promoters, it was the biggest problem playing live. They'd be like, oh, like we go to a club, they'd be like, hey, do you want to do a DJ set? And we're like, no, that's what everybody does. Can we like do like the drums and like the guitar and stuff? They're like, no, we don't do that. And then you talk to like a rock buyer and they'd be like, do you want to play with like this pop punk band? And we're like, that doesn't fit what we're doing. Like, so it was kind of hard to find, find our lane. But we wound up having, we had management for a bit, and then I did it myself after, where I just kind of managed it myself. And we had some pretty good opportunities that came along doing remixes for people. And we became friends with the Quest Crew guys, who were the dance crew for LMFAO.
They got
And
huge quickly. I remember when that happened. They were actually one of the headliners, I think, of this Bamboozle Festival with All Time Low, with Forever Six Kids, Boys Like Girls, Third Eye Blind. And then I saw they headlined the Staples Center, LMFAO. Like they were basically the band, well, the group that was kind of hip hop-y playing the scene shows, and then they just completely graduated. So speaking of graduating, sick transition, Scotty. Thank you, Scotty. You graduated Rutgers, correct?
I did.
Did you work at WM? Not, it wasn't WME at the time, right? It was just William Morris. Did you work there, or was it Endeavor? Endeavor, sorry. Was it William Morris Endeavor at the time, or was it just straight up William Morris when you were there?
It was William Morris Endeavor, 2009, they had the
Okay.
merger.
Word. I read that book on CAA Powerhouse, and it's amazing. But so what did you do there specifically? And then we're going to get to the meat and potatoes of actual management.
Yeah, I mean, WME was a great experience. It was humbling, to say the least, because it was going from making my own schedule and being in charge of, I guess, my own life, doing what I wanted, and trying to make my own business happen, to starting over from the bottom. And
Now we hear.
if you've read that book that you're talking about, the CAA one, or
Oh, I've read it.
there's The Mailroom, which is another great book if anyone's interested in getting into the agency world and wants to know a little bit about the history and what it's like. The Mailroom's a good book to read, and basically that's where you start. Like, I got kind of lucky that being in the music department was a little bit different than some of the other departments, but
Yeah, you don't
I
have to wear a
only was in
suit.
the mailroom for the first day.
One day, and then did you graduate to assistant, basically? Is that what you did, or?
No, you actually go to a place called Music Central. I don't believe any of the other agencies have it. They might have something similar to some degree. But at the time, it was just this room that held maybe 8 to 10 people in it. And it was like, you're kind of like, the good part about what WME did is it's almost like you're kind of moving up a system, and you're learning how everything works, and eventually getting all the knowledge that you need to do what you need to do to hopefully be your own agent. And so at Music Central, it was like basically you were the support to the support. So you were doing ticket counts for venues and reviewing contracts and all that kind of stuff. Basically, a lot of the stuff that might have been a little bit too tedious for the assistant to be able to handle all that on their own. So you just kind of learned your way. And it was cool because in the New York office it was a lot smaller, so we had a lot of assistants that were willing to kind of, I don't know, you say, mentor you and help you out. And you'd kind of go under their wing and learn the ropes with how they with how they function and how they work on the desks. And you were considered a floater, so whenever an agent was their assistant was out sick or on vacation or whatnot, you actually would have to go in and fill in, which definitely could be daunting because the first time you do it, you're like sitting in on this desk and you're like,
You have no idea what's going on.
I
None
have no idea what's
whatsoever.
going on. I can answer a phone. That's what I got.
And then they're going to ask you specific questions that you have to really, really bite your tongue and scroll to find out. It's a very fast-paced world, but if you survive that world, you're kind of out of the boot camp, they say, right?
And I would say, I'm sure being an agent is not for everyone, obviously, and being at an agency might not be for everyone, but I will always say, no matter what, it's definitely not a bad place to start for anyone who wants to be in entertainment, for a lot of reasons. One being that, you'll get to meet a lot of different kinds of people. I think the cool thing, which you kind of realize that even reading that book, The Mailroom, you see, like, whether it was David Geffen or Barry Diller, or, the list goes on and on. But, a lot of these people all started at William Morris Agency, and they were all in the mailroom together, and they all stayed friends. And it's like, now, at WME, I probably have, I don't know, 3 to 5 people who are agents now that started with me, across all of the offices, I think, in music, that is. And, they're agents there, but everybody else moved on to somewhere else, where now I know people kind of all across entertainment. Some people completely left entertainment, but it's almost like it's your, like you said, your boot camp, and you
A
kind of, it's
networking
your starting
hotbed.
network.
Oh, yeah. Well, we both said network simultaneously. It is honestly the best place to meet like-minded, driven people who are trying to pursue this craft. And obviously, like my wife actually worked at two agencies and she hated it. And some people just can't stand it and get burnt out by some people stay there for a while or pivot it to something else. So we're halfway done with this segment. So let's actually more than halfway. So you worked at Vector after that, but right now I just want to kind of talk about the Glitta Group, and I'll be straight up with you because I really don't want you to think, because I call people out on this show. I am not a kiss ass, but Owl, I'm telling you, and I used to pronounce it Owl because I'm a fucking moron, but Owl put on one of the best live shows I've seen this year. I saw it standing, I'd say. There was a girl in between us, so I saw it technically with you at Chain Reaction, and I was blowled away by Owl. That's all I gotta say. Sick find, incredible band. Tell me about how you started working with them, and they're on the label that we're talking about, Equal Vision, that had Saves the Day, that had Armor for Sleep, that had Coheed, Chiodos, you name it. So I want to hear as much about Owl as possible.
It was kind of interesting because for me, I never knew if I could be a manager per se. I was always kind of doing it from the beginning. I think I was sort of preparing myself for it, playing in bands and always sort of managing the manager and just kind of
You're that guy in the
wanting to.
band. You're that guy that you hate now. The one who's managing the manager.
Yeah, but
Yep, me
I don't
too.
know. I think I had my reasons to do it. I mean, I don't. I've never been somebody to, I don't get on anyone's case. I think I'm a pretty nice guy. I think my parents raised me pretty well. But
Glitta, you're a
yeah,
very nice
I just.
boy. You're very friendly and you're affable and you've got a little bit of an intellect, so you're good. Emily, what do you think of him so far in this call?
He's a great dude, great
Great dude.
person.
All right, back to you.
You got it, dude.
You got it, dude.
But I just I felt like, I was always interested in the business side of things, and obviously I felt like at some point I had a lot of people tell me they thought I'd be a good agent, but I moved on from that to the management thing because basically while I was booking, I kind of stumbled across this band, and for the longest time I was like, I don't know if I can be a manager because I'd rather play the music, and am I going to ever feel this way about an artist where it feels like I'm doing it. And the funny part was, is that when I met them, I had found them online. I went to go see him at this little place called Court Tavern in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Jersey!
Yeah, right
Sorry.
over by Rutgers.
Yeah.
Court Tavern has plenty of history, from Lifetime
Oh, dude,
to
Jersey's Best
Gaslight
Dancers.
Anthem, Patti
Wow.
Smith. A lot of people. Well, Gaslight was probably the last band to kind of come out of there, but. I saw them play there, and I was like, man, I'm like, no one has ever sounded this good in this venue. And the venue, traditionally doesn't sound very good, not the best PA or anything, especially for the kind of orchestral, music that they make.
Just that's an
So.
understatement, just so you know. Just you're putting it very mildly. Owl Live sounds like a symphonic rock band. It's huge. It's ginormous. So Chain Reaction, is mostly associated with Thrice, Avenged Sevenfold, and Newfound Glory, and bands like that. And I have never seen heard the room sound that big ever. So they're huge. I know we're big Trump fans. They're huge.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. It was just one of those situations where I saw them, I talked to them a bit, and then I went to go see them again at Arlene's Grocery, and same thing happened. I was like, man, this is the best I've ever heard anyone sound in this room. And, you know, they didn't have a front of house guy or anything. They were just doing it on their own. And, you know, I talked to them and I was like, listen, I'm just going to, you know, be straightforward with you. Like, I don't know if anything will happen, but you guys are too good to not be heard. And, you know, I might be crazy because you make 5 to 7 minute long songs.
Totally radio but, friendly.
You know, there's a niche for it. Someone's going to pay attention. It's just about getting you guys in the right spot. And at that point, I was like, I'm going to do what I can to try to help you be heard because you deserve it. And I don't know how this is going to happen or how we're going to make it work. And I've never technically managed another artist. But the thing that I told them was, you know, I thought that I couldn't ever be a manager. But when I see you guys, I wish I were in your band. And because I feel that way, I can work with you because your success is my success.
Listen, I tell every single person whenever they ask me, like, what does it take for me to manage a band, I say 100% of my love as far as being a fan, as far as loving the person. So if you're going to be on the phone with me, for example, pitching Owl for something, and I hear a shred of trepidation in your voice, I'm going to walk. And I can totally tell that you love the music. And I can also tell that you, I don't know if you like being band dad, but you, I think you really, really relish your role. We only have a few minutes left. So I guess with that time, I'm going to leave you to Florida to talk about the other projects you're working with.
Sure. So besides them, I have Eight Graves. Eight Graves are an alternative soul duo from the New York City area. Honestly, you know, I don't really exactly know what to compare them to because I think they have their own thing going on. But we've had a lot of success so far, you know, probably pushing the 3 million stream mark for being wholly independent ourselves, doing it on our own.
You like millions. You like streaming millions. That's a good stat. Like the other day, I had a song that had two plays. Two. Just I just want to let you know. No, I'm serious. Like two people in two different places listened to it. So roll with that. I know. So Eight Graves has the 3 millions. Owl has the millions of love and affinity in my heart. I own the vinyl, and it sounds even better on vinyl. And I know I probably sound like a pretentious Williamsburg douchebag, but it sounds so much better on vinyl. Do you agree? Have you heard it on vinyl?
I have, and it sounds great. And, you know, the interesting thing for me, especially when it comes to my artists, you know, in general, I also have a producer, Nick Gonsalves. He has his own studio, Control Space Studios, and basically produces, co-writes, and does whatever he can for other artists. But, you know, all of my artists to me, like, first and foremost, besides just making great music on their own, I like to find literally just that, artists. I can't really work with somebody who, like, I don't know if I could technically even work with a pop star that's just like, I don't, you know, do anything on my own. I just like finding raw talent, you know, like, yeah, maybe there's somebody, if, you know, he or she came along and they just had, you know, the most amazing voice I've ever heard, you know, they're the next Adele or whatever, Sam Smith. And I was like, listen, like, you know, whether you write your songs or not, like, your voice needs to be heard. And, you know, you cross that bridge when you get there. But for me, you know, all my artists are songwriters, artists themselves.
They're,
you know,
machines,
Brent from 8 Graves is a
pretty
popular tattoo artist. I mean, Jay from Owl, he engineered the record with Kevin Dye from Gates and produced it with him. And, you know, they're very much involved with, like, making the sound how they want it to be. And Jay's like ultra particular when it comes to how things sound. And I think that's great because he has a vision of what he wants it to sound like. And I think a big reason why it sounds so great on vinyl too is because how they approach the record. I think too many people these days, like, you know, something becomes an industry standard. I hate that term, but, you know, it's like,
it's a term, right? It's a term that we hate to say, but unfortunately it's a moray. So wrap this one up because I actually, believe it or not, I want to stay true to the hour that we said we would do. So wrap this up, and then I'm going to give you a shout out that you won't believe.
All right. Well, yeah. So basically all it was is that, you know, instead of mastering everything so loud and pushing it to the max, it was like, this record, you know, is organic and breathes and has, you know, again, you know, it's orchestral. It has, can, you know, if you listen to the strings solo, it sounds like a symphony. So I think Jay was pretty adamant about making sure that the record felt real and natural. And I think that's one of the things that comes across so great on vinyl. You know, whether you go back and listen to the Beatles or Zeppelin or Hendrix or, you know, the list goes on. So I think that's why the record sounds so great on vinyl.
It sounds amazing on vinyl, and you sound amazing on Adobe. So I guess, why don't you plug how people can get a hold of you or check out your socials, the Glitta group, whatever you want to say, and then I'll say a few words about our next few guests.
Sure. So you can listen to Owl's music at www.owlband.com.
It's spelled like Owl. Yes.
And 8 Graves is www.8graves.com. They're both on all of the streaming services, Spotify, YouTube, Apple Music, Amazon, Deezer, whatever, et cetera. List goes on and on. And they're great. When they're playing live and they're in your area, you should 100% check them out.
Without any shred of hesitation. And maybe you'll get at least 2 more streams because of the show. So I'll send you a royalty check. It's going to be pretty fucking bomb. So, Mike Glitta, you are awesome. Thank you for doing this. The next few weeks, we have packed with some awesome guests. We are actually recording Louis Bandak's interview in about an hour, but it will be airing a week from today. That's crazy. And today is not today. Time zones are fucked up. We've got Adam Mott, who formerly managed We Came as Romans and Thursday, and now manages a band called Closure, a band called The Color Morale. He's on the following week. We've got Eric German, who is an attorney for Steel Panther, Black Veil Brides, Asking Alexandria. He is the hard rock attorney. And then we got my boy Shane from the band Silverstein. And we're going to be talking about Lead Singer Syndrome, which is his podcast. So, Mike, do you have any final thoughts a la Jerry Springer?
No. Those people are all great people, and you should all listen to them. Shane's an awesome dude, too, and has a great podcast.
Awesome. Lead Singer Syndrome. Well, he can interview the guy who sang for Love Automatic if he wants to. So thank you guys so much for listening to the show every single Tuesday, 5 o'clock Pacific time, PT, 8 o'clock Eastern time. And in addition, Emily, when are we rerunning on Sundays?
Sundays, 8 a.m. Eastern.
Damn right. So if you are an insomniac and raging against the machine in L.A. and you are up at 4:47, stay up 13 more minutes. Check out Waldman's Words on Adobe, home of the Andrew. Mike, I appreciate your time. It is exactly 9:59 my time, so we did it.
We did.
All right. Have a great day, everyone listening, and please tip your bartenders.